And we continue with paper 9E on measurement, and I give the floor to Raghava.
Thank you, Andreas. So, like recognition, the feedback was largely positive on the measurement proposals. Most respondents who commented on the board's proposal, agreed with the board's proposal that regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities should be measured using a cash flow-based measurement technique, and that an entity estimates uncertain cash flows applying the most likely amount method or the expected value method, whichever better predicts the cash flows. A few respondents who agreed with the proposals made a few suggestions, one of which is a suggestion that the board should impose a constraint similar to the constraint on variable consideration imposed by IFRS 15, especially on regulatory assets associated with performance incentives. So that was one of the main suggestions that came through. A few respondents, mainly European preparers with rate-regulated activities in the United States, disagreed with the cash flow-based measurement technique, and they preferred the cost deferral model in US GAAP. And in relation to uncertain cash flows, a few respondents, mainly accounting firms and a few national standard setters and a few preparers, disagreed with using the expected value method, mainly due to concerns about the complexity in applying the method. And they instead suggested the board require an entity to use the most likely amount method combined with the constraint similar to the variable consideration constraint. So with that, over to you for your comments and thoughts on the paper.
Thank you, Raghava.
I had a specific concern I just wanted to raise that on paragraphs 3C and 35B, they talk about this issue about should you be allowed to change between the expected value and the most likely amount. And they actually recommend in 35B, the suggestion is that they should be able to change to the one that best represents. And I think that's one that we should think about carefully. And the reason for that is there's a fundamental inconsistency between... There's a fundamental inconsistency between what we decided to do with respect to a prohibition on changing methods and what we decided on impairment. So we said, you don't need to do impairment because every period you're going to reestimate the amounts. But that only works really if you're using expected value. Think about if you're using most likely amount. You start off and suppose it's 97% of the time is the expectation that the single amount will be there, 3% is on the left side, and you say, no problem, it's most likely amount. Suppose the next year the most likely amount is now 30% probability and there's a long left tail going down to zero. You would probably be impairing this. But you're still, your most likely amount still holds because that's 30% of the time. And that, I think it's an inconsistency because I don't think we can continue to have, we don't need impairment unless we do something with this choice about expected value versus most likely amount. If we choose not to do something with expected value, most likely amount, we need to reconsider impairment. But I don't think we can just leave that inconsistency. And it wasn't something that occurred to me when we first put it out, but it did after when reading stuff and thinking about it.
Thank you, Tom. Mary?
Let me start with impairment. I think I want to reflect on Tom's comment a bit more offline. But I was looking at paragraph 21, C, that says the calculations required to apply a cash flow-based measurement technique would be operationally challenging. But presumably, even if we gave some relief on that, and I'm not encouraging, given the relatively high level of support we had for it, I'm not really encouraging that. But I think, again, the point is if we move to another method, we would still have to have then impairment as a backstop. And if we have impairment as a backstop, you're back into calculating cash flows, and I just think there's no way around the fact that you have to do it. And one other comment is in respect of the comment about should there be a cap that's analogous to IFRS 15's variable consideration threshold for recognizing it? I'd be really skeptical about that, because as opposed to this standard being the activity type specific version of a revenue standard, it's not. It's a complement to the revenue standard. And we put the variable consideration special guidance into 15. It isn't really a cap, the kind of threshold, the higher threshold, because we heard from users that revenue and having revenue that's not distorted by adjustments relating to prior periods was really important for their forecasting. I don't see regulatory income and expense having the same kind of projection, cash flow, future cash flow estimation role that, that we were worried about with revenue that led us to the IFRS 15 threshold for variable consideration. I think in the rate regulated activities standard, we are saying what is the sum total population of adjustments that are known based on performance to date for the things that you have recognized already. And so I don't worry about getting the same kind of cap in there for that. So I think even though we have that precedent in the revenue standard, I don't think it carries over from revenue to a line item, that even though it's right below that, is a different line item.
Can I just ask me a question? Just thinking through it, it wouldn't be consistent to have adjusted for it, though. Sorry, Mary.
It wouldn't. So you're saying wouldn't it be consistent to say if you were going to constrain the revenue when you recognize it on your customer to constrain it in the adjustments category? I don't think so, because it doesn't really relate to the trend. The higher hurdle would relate to your understanding with the regulator, not to how is the customer going to behave and therefore how is it going to affect the transaction between me and the customer. Because, the revenue line is what I'm billing to my customers, while the uncertainty that I think they're talking about with incentives is whether I will cross the threshold or whether the regulator will allow me to have it. So it's kind of an input uncertainty rather than a customer behavior one.
That's what you're saying. Yeah, thanks.
Tadeu?
Thank you, Andreas. A quick point on paragraph 24, estimating cash flows. And then there were a lot of suggestions from the respondents. I understand some of them, but actually they are not specifically related to our proposal. I mean, that it is applicable for every single measurement that we are applying in IFRS. But it's worth still looking at some of them, especially when they talk about examples, whether we can get something to help to estimate the amounts related to the proposal we are making. And just about the impairment, the very beginning of the proposal, we also discussed about whether we should require impairment or not. And then the answer was that the method used for determining the amount would not require it. And I acknowledge what Tom said, but I thought from the practical point of view that when we say that the measurement method, whichever better predicts the cash flows, to the end of the day, it would be adjusted. I understood what Tom said, but I haven't predicted that actually we would have, for example, not considered any need of reducing the amount of the special asset to something that is different from the two method. I mean, that has to be one of the two, and then it would automatically adjust. But let's discuss this.
Thank you. I don't see any more name tags up?
Thank you. So I want to understand more about the discussion of the application of highly probable threshold, especially because when IFRS 15, this part was discussed, probably usefulness of information was questioned by the users, how reliable the revenue amount will be using the ordinary estimation. So because of that, the highly probable threshold was implemented as a kind of the second layer. So anyway, the entity will have to deal with the first layer's estimation before applying the highly probable threshold. So I think what I meant is whether the user has any need about the implementation of highly probable threshold in connection with this proposal.
I mean, I don't think we've got any specific feedback from users on the threshold that they've proposed.
Yes, well, I think general comment was that they would be concerned if something is recognized and then the regulator decided afterwards that that item did not go through. And then they are a bit concerned about reversals of regulatory assets being recognized in one period, and because the regulator decides something different, then so there was some comments around these uncertainties, and then the suggestion was, well, this will depend highly on judgment, and we would like to see the disclosures about that.
Yeah.
But as I think Mary also said, so all of these comments about the highly probable threshold deal with performance incentives, and mainly performance incentives that test a performance that lasts more than one period. And this is then when the uncertainty is about measurement, but also the existence of an enforceable right to some extent as well, so arise.
That's good. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, I think that brings us to the end of this paper. Thank you, Raghava. And we welcome Shukman to the table. That is Shukman's first appearance to the board. You have seen that we can behave and can be very, very nice to staff. So please let us hear the feedback on the discount rate.
I'm covering agenda paper 9F on discount rate. The paper summarizes the feedback received on the discount rate the entity uses to measure regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. There are three main proposals. The first proposal is that an entity uses the regulatory interest rate as a discount rate, except in specific circumstances. Most respondents include users of financial statements agreed with the proposals. However, many respondents actually, you know, suggested for an exemption from discounting if, for example, the effect of discounting is not significant or the regulatory assets or regulatory liability is expected to be recovered or fulfilled within a specified period, say, for example, 1 year. The second proposal is that an entity uses the minimum interest rate as a discount rate if the regulatory interest rate for regulatory assets is insufficient to compensate for time value of money and for uncertainty in future cash flows. Now, in this case, most respondents include users of financial statements did not support this proposal. The main concerns were basically, you know, on two areas. The first area is basically, you know, they think that, you know, the cost of applying, you know, the proposal would outweigh the benefits arising from using the proposal. The second concern was basically surrounding, you know, the asymmetric treatment between regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. In their mind, you know, in their view, you know, may result in outcomes that may undermine, you know, the understandability and neutrality of the information provided. And most of these respondents instead prefer to use the regulatory interest rate for all regulatory assets and all regulatory liabilities in all circumstances, which then reinforced basically the support for, you know, the first proposal. The third proposal is that an entity will translate uneven interest rate, regulatory interest rate specified by regulatory agreement into a single discount rate and use that single discount rate over the life of a regulatory asset or a regulatory liability. For these proposals, basically, there were mixed views. Basically, would between, you know, whether the proposal would simplify or instead make the proposal more complex to apply. And last but not least, some respondents asked for clarification and additional guidance, such as, for example, how does an entity determine the discount rate if, for example, the regulatory agreement does not specify the regulatory interest rate? Or how does an entity determine the minimum interest rate and what factors to be considered? I'll hand over to the board for comments and thank you.
Thank you, Sharma. Comments?
Thank you. I think it's Anne first, isn't it?
Could do Anne first. That's fine. Gentlemen. Sorry about
thanks, Tadeo.
That's all right.
Always a gentleman. So discount rates. We've got great support for using the interest rate in the regulatory agreement. Well, no surprise there, given that so many people want us to do what's in the regulatory agreement. But I remember our discussions about this around the board table, and we were looking for something that would be a suitable way of approaching this and using the regulatory agreement out of the using the interest rate out of the regulatory agreement made sense. So lots of support there, but not on our proposals around the minimum interest rate. So that's going to be something that we're going to have to go back and have a look at. We wanted to pursue the minimum interest rate in certain circumstances, but we're not really sure how extensive those circumstances are. So as we go back and reconsider, we think it's going to be quite rare that people would be making use of this minimum interest rate, but we don't actually know that. So it's really hard to predict at this point the effect of not having the minimum interest rate proposal. So I think that's something that the staff will need to look at for us and discuss. And that's all I've got to say at the moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. And over to you, Steve.
Thank you, Andreas. Well, I think that when we discuss discount rate, it's interesting that most of these respondents supported instead using the regulatory interest rate as a discount rate for all regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in all circumstances. I mean that independent whether this is sufficient or not, or sometimes it simply doesn't have interest rate. I mean, it doesn't look very sounding. Just look at the regulatory rate without actually taking into consideration the sufficiency of the rate. But I acknowledge, and that it's clear in the feedback, that this approach might not be the most popular one. But one thing that I really found interesting is that if we just look at the proposals, some propose using the regulatory rate, some proposal suggests using other discount rates, and then we start looking at, it seems that every single respondent have your own way of saying what should be the discount rate to be used. It's just clear that how this is not an easy subject. Discount rate is not exclusive for rate regulation. I mean that we have around the financial statements. I mean that we have to think about a, let's say, holistic solution to deal with that. Again, clear feedback that the minimum interest rate, it's not, as I said, popular. But I think that also the suggestions that we received, they are not very helpful, because actually there isn't consensus between the respondents. That's why I could take from, I mean, that it's a very big challenge for the project team. Thank you.
Thanks, Deo. Mary.
Contextual comment first, and then a couple of observations. One is, I think it would be good to remind ourselves and stakeholders that we're having this discussion about interest rates after we've just lived through what I feel is a historically extended period of historically low rates. And so people are maybe, you know, we've gotten used to really not having to worry about time value of money. Mm-hmm. And the issue of how important is it to make something that you don't get to include in a rate for 15 or 20 years, thinking of allowance for funds used under construction, look as if it's something that you're going to get today. So I think discounting is critical. And as soon as we say use the rate in the agreement, which I think was a major pragmatic cost benefit, concession, as it were, that was included in the ED, we have to include some kind of backstop, because otherwise agreements, you know, when you're negotiating what the terms are, you say, yeah, but don't worry, don't pay it to me for 20 years and don't specify an interest rate, because as soon as it's not specified, you don't have to deal with it. So I think it's a non-starter to say use the rate without, you know, use the regulatory rate without any constraints or parameters for when you have to adjust it. And, you know, I think there was some, I think, quite constructive input, suggestions about things we might want to think about in terms of maybe practical expedience, and I'd encourage the staff to think about those rather than just, you know, getting involved in a what are the pros and cons of just going to a straight, you know, the regulatory agreement rate, which include, though, to me, a bit of caution about just following the model in IFRS 15. And one of the reasons for IFRS 15 is the IFRS 15 number, which is the top line, already has that concession built into it. And the things that are going into regulatory income and regulatory expense, and, you know, for the recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities, are things that may be settled in the short term or may be settled over much longer terms. And actually, when we brought in the practical expedient for IFRS 15, what we heard a bit after the fact from some jurisdictions that had, at the time, higher inflation rates than we were dealing with, and I'm looking at today, I'm thinking of Latin America in particular, saying when you give a time-based relief, you don't have to do it if it's within a year. That could be a very significant adjustment in some economies. And yet I think in order to provide meaningful relief, it's got to be specified as a time period. Otherwise, people will end up spending their time doing calculations to prove that there isn't a need to do the calculations. And, you know, and that's not really relief. So I think we'd have to think about it that way. I think, you know, we heard some pushback on whether the IFRS 15 relief is too generous. So I'd maybe encourage, you know, if there's follow-up on this, on how we could phrase it in what works, to think about talking maybe with NSS, national standard setters, in countries that have recently been experiencing higher, not hyper, but higher inflation levels. So that's one piece of follow-up. A second is, in terms of another possible practical expedient, and came to mind when I was looking at your summary in paragraph 34 and 34D in particular, would we think about saying something like, if you can... giving preparers an alternative of saying, if you review the process and the inputs that are used to establish the rates for each regulator or for each type of difference, and you know you have to revisit that periodically, and maybe that's, I'm making this up, so you know maybe that's once a year or something like that, then you can rely on that kind of process and controls assessment to not have to do the assessment of the individual rates that are set according to that process, as long as you review and make sure that it's still a reasonable reflection of the duration and variability. So you still have to do some work to think about what the process is, but you don't have to prove it on an item by item basis. So not saying it's a silver bullet, it may be a really bad idea, but in terms of trying to come up with other practical expedients to think about pursuing, that's one thing. And then shifting to the concerns about the asymmetry between the return on assets and the interest rate on liabilities, what I inferred from the comments that you focused on in the summary is that some people said, yeah, I know I may have a rate that is not adequate on the asset side, but on the other hand, since the same rate applies either to liabilities that are netted against that and it's charged on a net basis, or the same rate applies to liabilities, there's a natural offset, and so that it compensates to some extent for that. And that takes me back to thinking about what some people think of as our IFRS 9 land, some may think of as SUE land, which is, you know, when we faced that problem in IFRS 9, we ended up introducing an option but not a requirement to measure liabilities at fair value. And I think the analog to consider here would be an option but not a requirement to reflect a gain for a too low interest rate remeasurement for that, in some circumstances perhaps. And again, I'm not saying I want this, but when I try to think about the concerns that people expressed, and there seemed to be some who were focused on the asymmetry as producing distortion because it would force recognition of something on the asset side that wouldn't recognize a corresponding economic gain that was part of the overall structural design. That's the only way I can think of addressing that. So those are my suggestions of possible practical expedients to look at cautiously and maybe in a more limited way than we did for IFRS 15 in terms of reducing the cost. But to me, it's a non-starter to say just follow the rate specified in the regulatory agreement without any conditions or parameters on that.
Thanks. Some very similar comments just around the rates. I mean, to start off with, and I was going to draw exactly the same comment as Mary around the discounting. I mean, I can appreciate that we do need to look at some exemptions around where they go, but I know that coming from a jurisdiction where interest rates are a little bit higher, even prior to 15, I mean, the challenge has always been when somebody says, well, discounting is not material, and then the auditors tell you to prove it, and the next thing you're sitting and doing all the work anyhow. So I think we need to... I very much relate to that. I don't know if there's a better answer than the 12 months, but sometimes it's a practical way of looking at it. But I think we need to explore what potentially we could do in that area, because I do think that does become a challenge for people. The one I just also want to comment on was just around the use of the minimum rate, the minimum interest rate. I mean, we took a decision in the CD to use a regulatory rate, which is obviously something different to what we would normally do in terms of discounting. I worry about, my concern around the minimum rate is that we're going to introduce a complexity in which people now have to assess the rate, and how do we know that rate is, what makes it up, and how do we know whether it's effective, and then of course you've got to go see what the minimum is, and et cetera, and is it being compensated for time? My worry is that we're going to create such complexity for people in terms of what they've got to do in that assessment, that you're going to need quite a bit of time for somebody to sit down and really understand whether or not and make that assessment. And then I think on the regulatory audit side, you've got somebody on the other side who's got to now explain why, of course, that this has been adjusted or hasn't been adjusted and what justification you've made. I guess I think what I'd like to understand more, I guess, is what I'm saying is probably a little bit more around kind of what is the impact of not having that clause. So if we chose not to do it,
Would it be that important? And I mean, I thought it was quite interesting we mentioned in 29C that, I mean, this is very infrequent. Well, the feedback was that this is infrequent to start with. So I guess I just don't want to introduce a very onerous provision that people now to all go and do these assessments when it's so infrequent that they would all be outside of where that would apply anyhow, that we're just creating complexity where it doesn't really need to be there. And maybe there's a better way to resolve that.
Thanks, Bruce. Sue?
I'm sitting here having flashbacks to conversations about discount rates sitting in the Cannon Room back in Cannon Street, because we discussed a lot of these issues when we were developing the exposure draft, and of course we should discuss them again. And the only reason I put my card up, it was actually about the IFRS 15 12-month thing. We talked about that and decided that it didn't make sense for some reason back in the day, because I can remember the staff had a reason for why they thought it wasn't appropriate in this context. And we've had discussions about, was this whole minimum rate too complicated, and we wanted to maximise the use of the regulatory rate. So I guess just a plea that when we come back and look at these items, of course we've got the benefit of a lot of feedback and different views and new information, but let's remind the board of the conversations we've had in the past and how we got where we did as well, so we don't reinvent the wheel too much.
That'd be good. All right. I think that is all on this paper.
Just a quick question before we close. Did the users, one of the big things that surprised me was that the users weren't keen on it. Did they say, and Mary listed some of the, you know, problems, you know, offset my liabilities, a small number. Did the users say why they didn't think it was good? Could you elaborate a little bit?
They didn't explain us a lot about why they did not prefer the minimum interest rate. They said that they would prefer us to use always the regulatory interest rate. It could be confusing. They might not necessarily. So comparability between companies as well. So how every company might end up like determining that rate. Yeah, so I think it is more to, for them, is we want to see what we have in the regulatory agreement we can reconcile back to, and that's more useful to us. If there is anything that we don't agree, probably we adjust it ourselves, I guess. So,
I think the regulatory interest rate probably gets them to the future cash flows that would be arising when they charge customers, unlike a minimum interest rate, which is, again, which could be different from the ultimate cash flows. Yeah.
Go to the next paper.
Okay. The next paper, agenda paper 9J, basically deals with, you know, the measurement and presentation proposals for items affecting regulatory rates on a cash basis. In respect of the measurement proposal, most respondents agreed with the proposal to measure the regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities using the measurement basis applied to the related liability or related assets applying IFRS standards. A few respondents raised questions about limiting that proposal to items affecting regulatory rates only on a cash basis. They raised examples such as, for example, you know, if items were affecting regulatory rates on a accrual basis but is on another gap, for example, or if only, you know, a substantial part but not the entire part of the item affected on a cash basis. In relation to the presentation proposal, most respondents agreed with the proposal to present in OCI regulatory income and regulatory expense that arise from remeasurement of related liability and related assets through OCI. A few respondents, basically in Asia Oceania and Latin America, supported presenting all regulatory income and all regulatory expense in profit or loss. According to this respondent, they said that this presentation would portray better the total allowed compensation for goods and services supplied during the period and would avoid complexity when part of the regulatory income expense of whole of them is recognized in OCI. On the other hand, a few respondents, mainly from North America, supporting extending the proposal to all regulatory income or regulatory expense that arise from remeasurement of related liability or related assets through OCI. So you can see basically two camps of that. A few respondents asked whether and how the cumulative amount in OCI should be reclassified to profit or loss. Again, I'll hand over to the board for comments.
Thank you, Shaman. Questions? Comments? Christoph?
Mary, he said.
Mary?
I'll kick us off just with a comment about what we do and don't pursue. Your paragraph 5 talks, you know, as you just summarized, about extending this special presentation proposal to all regulatory income and expense. And I mean, it feels like it was an indirect way of saying, don't you want to do a cost capitalization, cost deferral approach? But I may be misunderstanding that, you know, because my thought is, if you're measuring the regulatory asset or liability based on the IFRS measurement of the underlying, essentially what you're doing is, you know, is the same or closer to the cost deferral method. If that understanding is correct, then it seems like it's an indirect way of somebody saying deviate from the fundamental approach of the project, and so it isn't a tweak. Now, I may be misunderstanding, and there's a narrower population that those few were going for, but I guess I'd say if it's different, could you either explain it now or explain it before spending a lot of time following up the suggestion that came from just a few? So it's that specific comment. And then I also saw that there were some concerns expressed about whether some of the things that would be covered by this exemption might be outside the boundary of the regulatory agreement. And I think there is that risk, because these are presumably the things that are furthest, you know, from what we understand, this would apply to items that relate to generally expenses that are pretty far in the future. And so they do have the highest likelihood of being outside the boundary. But how can you say I have an asset or liability that meets the definition of an asset or liability if you don't have a binding agreement that covers it? So I think that's just life.
Thank you. Tadeo?
Thank you, Andreas. Just a comment on paragraph 6 related to some few respondents, actually, that disagreed with the presentation in using the other comprehensive income. I mean, that they believe that all should go to P&L. I mean, that this is, I was just thinking when I read this one, that when they mention additional complexity, at the moment that you determine what is the amount that should go to OCI, it is easy. But I'm just wondering whether we can explore the complexity about carrying out with this amount and have to control when this is actually recycling the rate. And then you have to follow the same accounting principle that you have designated for example, gain, actuarial gain loss. I mean, just to follow the same accounting treatment in terms of realization, even if it is within equity. I know that there were some comments on whether it should be in the future recycled to P&L. I don't think it would, but just within equity, we may need to track this one and do the same accounting. I mean, that I think it's worth assessing this complexity here. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. That was a quick one.
Yeah.
Well done. Thank you. So that then brings us to our last paper. And whilst I have the floor, I might just inform our audience, plus our two board members that have dialed in remotely, that after this session, we will pull forward from tomorrow the remaining paper for the PFS session.
right? So at 3 o'clock, likely around, well, 3:30 probably, we will be, no, 3 o'clock, we will be starting with a PFS paper, 21D.
Yeah, it's 2:25 now.
Well, let's see. I mean, this probably, I think 9H will probably get a bit more discussion. We have touched on it for 12 this morning already, but let's see what Raghav has for us.
IFRIC 12 has already been extensively covered, so yeah, but this paper again. So the board proposed guidance on interaction with IAS 12 and IFRIC 12 explicitly, and the board also proposed a few amendments to other IFR standards. So in relation to the proposed guidance on interaction with IAS 12, most respondents who commented suggested the board provide detailed guidance and examples and possibly amend the existing illustrative examples to also include the tax assumptions and explain the interaction. Currently we have one paragraph on the interaction with IFRIC 12 in the exposure draft, and most respondents who commented said that paragraph is insufficient, and they suggested the board provide detailed guidance and examples covering the application of the exposure draft in all the three models of IFRIC 12, financial asset model, intangible asset model, and the hybrid model. In relation to the amendments to other IFRS standards, largely respondents have been supportive with a few suggestions about a few more amendments or a few more guidance. So with that, over to you on your thoughts and comments on the paper.
Board is exhausted. Mary still has firepower.
Never too tired to talk about it for 12.
Here we go.
No, I was going to say, but, you know, my first reaction to the list of questions in paragraph 15 is more that these are about application questions of IFRIC 12 than they are about, strictly speaking, the interaction between the rate regulatory ED and IFRIC 12. I think there is, you know, they're not off base. There is some crossover, but I think my reaction to them was that more reflects these are areas where we sometimes struggle in IFRIC 12, and maybe they're kind of projecting that expectation to the rate regulated standard rather than it being strictly a crossover point. Paragraph 16, I was a little concerned about the idea they changed the way they report on specified rights and obligations in a service concession and basically move them from accounting for, you know, under IFRIC 12 to, my reading of this is we might move things from under IFRIC 12 to being rate regulated. Well, if they're within the scope of IFRIC 12, I think, you know, it comes back to we've really got to be clear throughout the standard for a number of issues in messaging that the first you apply the other IFRS standards, and IFRIC 12 is an interpretation of other IFRS standards, and then you apply the rate regulated supplement to that. So I don't think you could take things out of IFRIC 12 and put them into rate regulated instead. It doesn't compute to me. And then on paragraph 28, 29, I guess it's just a suggestion from one, so we, you know, don't need to be too, I'm not going to be too elaborate in my comments, but these suggestions, again, are just aimed at trying to create an exemption for rate-regulated entities to modify their IFRS counting so that it lines up more closely with the regulatory, you know, calculations, and that's not the project design, so there hasn't been, to me, a compelling argument put forward why these would be particularly useful, valuable, or important practical expedience, so would not be supportive of pursuing 28 and 29 any further.
Thank you, Andreas. In relation to IFRIC 12, definitely, I think that it's very simple, the reference that we have in the exposure draft. And then when we go to the countries where there is this issue, the application of IFRIC 12 is very relevant. That's why these country jurisdictions are asking for more clarification of the interaction between the two. But just one point in relation to some countries, they were able for any reason to stretch and be able to recognize some of assets and liability that would be typically regulatory asset and regulatory liabilities. And then they have to apply the IFRS 9. And then they have some difficulties in terms of what kind of asset would be that one. That it wouldn't be an SPPI, would not meet the definition of SPPI. And then it involves some complexity when measuring these assets and liabilities. And then when we are able to move, provided that this is possible, to this another standard, maybe people are thinking that they would get a measurement that is more closer, let's say, is closer to what they have in mind in terms of the amount that they have to recover or to settle. But definitely my general comment on the District 12 is that we do need to do some, to provide a bit more guidance, illustrative example, whatever, because it's a very important interaction with this proposal. And just one final comment on the impairment of assets. In paragraph 24, you say that most respondents who commented, the mainly accounting firms, suggested the board provide guidance, illustrative examples of applying the proposed amendments to paragraph 79 of IS 36. A few of them said that it may not always be possible to separate cash flows of regulatory assets, regulatory liabilities from the cash flow of a cash generative unit. I think that's a very valid point. I don't know whether we have discussed this in IS 36 before, but I think that this is a really true and valid point that I suggest the project team to explore. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Kincho?
Thank you, Andres. Just a couple of comments. First, in relation to the IFRIC 12, I have sympathy with those comments or feedback we received from stakeholders, because I think the paragraph B47 of exposure draft, actually, it's not sufficient. So add additional guidance or illustrated examples, I think it's really necessary. So this is first comment. Second comment relating to paragraph 19A, because some stakeholders mentioned that the proposal may not, how the proposal can apply to those PPE, you know, which measured at a revaluation model applying IAS 16. I'm not pretty much sure what kind of issues they're talking about. So because from my perspective, first, initial recognition and measurement would be the same. So, and normally initial measurement will have some impact on regulated assets and liability and how subsequent measurement of those PPE, because they have been completed construction, they have been put into use, will have some impact on regulated assets and liability. The only area I'm thinking about that, because here he say the comments made, all those PPE are using revaluation model. If the rate determined based on the cost, and the cost would include depreciation of those PPE, would have some impact on those rates, how those rates are determined, but I'm not sure. But here they mentioned using revaluation. Because using revaluation, they will not get the, you know, the data of depreciation. But I just want to check what issues they are talking about. So this is second.
I think in one of the outreach events we had an example of where the cost of PP&E was going into the rates at an indexed cost basis, whereas for financial reporting purposes they had to do a revaluation model. So I think the question is, do these, so there's a difference again there between what goes into financial reporting versus what goes into rates. So I'm guessing that what they probably meant is, does this difference again give rise to regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities? I'm based on what we've got, I'm probably assuming that's their question, or that is what they want us to clarify or explain or explore. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Just Jinjiao, on that, I'm wondering, given Raghava's explanation, if what maybe is underlying it is, if we use an indexation that is kind of similar to but not quite meeting the requirements in IS 16 for revaluation, can you cut us some slack and let us call it a revaluation approach so we don't have a difference?
I'll have to get the...
No, that sounded more pejorative than it was. I'm just wondering if the request is as simple as that.
Okay. I think check the correlator and check the feedback we see, whether there are some examples, you know, in place, because why they raise this issue. If the issue is there, I think it's a very important issue. We need to look at it. Mm. Because previously we did not. I think from my point of view, I built on those PPE actually are measured at historical cost.
Yes.
And then, yeah.
I think their point was also that in the ED we have examples that assume the measurement basis of the PPE is cost. And then they were saying, well, in our case, it's fair value, so it's the revaluation model. So what do we do then? So can you please give us some examples to understand what we should do? So it is also based on they didn't have reference points in the ED.
Another comment is about also paragraph 19I. Also, some stakeholders raised an issue about interaction between this project with IFRS 16 leases, but there is no detailed, you know, examples of what kind of issues it is. So I think maybe clarification what kind of issues we're going to address and look at the details maybe will be helpful for us. Thank you.
It was just to reiterate my comments on IFRIC 12 again. I agree with Marie that in paragraph 15 the questions raised are mostly questions for IFRIC 12 rather than anything else. So if I understand perfectly Tadeu and Jinxiao's concern on the interaction, I would urge the staff first to begin to set or to draw a line between IFRIC 12 and regulated activities, because in a best case scenario there might be even no interaction in effect. So it's where I would be very, very cautious there. For those that apply IFRIC 12 and feel that they are absolutely not in any form of rate regulated activity, I would like to understand why they have those views.
Okay. And finally, Anne.
Thanks, Andreas. Just back to Jen Chow's point about paragraph 19, there's two things going on. One is it's to do with the public sector entities in Australia that use replacement cost. So IAS 16, and they take a replacement cost and they are using that for PP&E. So there were two things. One was that the exposure draft, all the examples assumed that historical cost was always used under IAS 16, which was the point Mariella made. And then the other point is, again, the separation from what the regulatory asset base looks like under the regulatory agreement versus what the assets look like under IFRS 16. So under IFRS 16, they're at replacement cost, but under the regulatory agreement, the regulatory asset base is a different value, so you're getting the difference there, and then that same discussion that we've already had is that, does this give rise to a regulatory asset and regulatory liability? Because there is a difference in how the assets are measured under the regulatory agreement or under IAS 16. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. I think we can conclude the session.
Well, thank you very much for listening to us, for listening to the feedback that we have received from stakeholders.
We will get back to you next month to discuss the feedback received on the remaining aspects of the model. And also thank you very much because you have, apart from providing your views, you have also given us some tips in how you would be addressing those comments, and that's very helpful for the staff. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for bringing the papers and for the considerate feedback. So we close off that topic. I would suggest that we do a 3-minute stretch break, and then at 2:45 we start with PFS.